You're listening to Nick Espinoza here on the Deep Dive Radio Show on Huntley Community Radio, WHRULP, on 101.5 FM.
Moving on, let's talk about a fake data breach alert. That's right, fake, and it's getting people hacked. This is a phishing scam, and it's underway that is targeting people that use the Ledger wallet. This is basically a cryptocurrency wallet, and it's targeting those users with a fake data breach notification that is used to steal cryptocurrency from the recipients. Now, Ledger is a hardware cryptocurrency wallet that allows you to store, manage, and sell cryptocurrency. The funds held in these wallets are secured using a 24-word recovery phrase, and they also support 12, 18, or 24-word recovery phrases used by other wallets as well. So you can integrate your wallets into Ledger. Anyone who knows this recovery phrase can then use it to access the funds that it secures and therefore steal it. So basically, attackers were sending out messages saying your account was compromised. Please go and log in. It would take you to a phishing site. You'd punch in your 24-character super safe password. They would grab it, log in as you, and then boom, get access to your coins, your bitcoins, your cryptocurrency, and then just move them out of your account. That is obviously a very huge problem. Moving on, and this is a tough one. We need to talk about FireEye. They are a majorly well-known cybersecurity firm. And they disclosed about a week ago or so that a, quote, highly sophisticated state-sponsored adversary had stolen the company's basically proprietary red teaming tools. Now, if you don't know what red teaming is, in cybersecurity, the red team is the offensive team. So if your company hires, let's say me, for example, to red team you, I am actively looking to break into you. The blue team is the one that is looking to defend me. See the red team coming, shut them down, all this kind of stuff. So red teaming tools are those that are offensive in nature. And to quote FireEye, the stolen tools range from simple scripts used for automating reconnaissance to entire frameworks that are similar to publicly available technologies such as Cobalt Strike and Metasploit. Those are both very heavily used by red teams. To continue, many of the red team tools have already been released to the community and are already distributed in our open source virtual machine, Commando VM. Some of the tools are publicly available tools modified to evade basic security detection mechanisms. Other tools and frameworks were developed in-house for our red team. Now, the Wall Street Journal cited a source close to the matter saying that Russia's Foreign Intelligence Service, the SVR, is viewed as the top suspect here. One of the most known of those groups is what is called APT, or Advanced Persistent Threat 29. You may know them as Cozy Bear. They are very well known as a threat actor that belongs to the SVR. FireEye, though, hasn't publicly named a particular group. And while FireEye's arsenal may prove useful for various reasons, the publication Wired essentially noted that the tools that they stole were basically out there already, that there were equivalent or better tools that state-sponsored actors have. In other words, if you look at the NSA, they got tools hit around 2018 or 2017, and those were called it was called the Shadow Broker hit, because the group that hit them were known as the Shadow Brokers. Those were very sophisticated, that were designed to evade a lot of firewalls like Cisco, like Cisco's brand and everything else. That was much more sophisticated than what FireEye is doing here. So FireEye is basically saying, yeah, well, it sucks we got hit. The tools they got, there are better ones out there right now. These were a lot more basic. And so hopefully FireEye was right. Hopefully that does not go deeper than what they are stating, because obviously they have a lot of contracts, both in the public and private sector. And so having a cybersecurity firm hit in that manner, or their specialized tools that they help to validate that security is good, it's never a good thing to see. So hopefully FireEye will get back on their feet. And finally, we have three stories for you here as the final breaches, and they all relate essentially around COVID. And the reason being is that we have seen a rather prolific attack pattern hitting essentially anything to do with COVID or its supply chain. And with that, let's start with the supply chain, because sources reporting to the publication Security Insiders say that the attackers, basically in the disguise of a Chinese cold refrigeration supplier, hit the database of what's called the Gavi Vaccine Alliance via a phishing campaign. By virtue of that, they ciphered data related to users and passwords. Now, the motive behind the attack is simple. Simply disrupt the vaccine supply chain and push the world into more suffering. It's pretty obvious. Now, security analysts say that vaccine manufacturers and those involved in vaccine research and development, plus the ones involved in the supply chain, have attained a new type of status called global critical infrastructure. And hitting such platforms could help essentially propagate the pandemic, which is the deadly intention that we are seeing here. Now, researchers at IBM, these are the ones that discovered the supply chain attack, aren't sure whether the hackers got success in their campaign, which started in September and was detected in October. However, the research team was quick enough to inform the FBI on the issue and feel that the cybersecurity measures deployed by the Gavi Vaccine Alliance may have saved it from obviously embarrassment, being hacked, being shut down, whatever that is. That is a huge, huge problem. And so our supply chains are continuously under attack. And in cybersecurity, we really have to focus on that. That is a huge, huge issue. Moving on, let's actually talk about biohacking. Because this is another issue that we really don't think about, but this is a type of data breach. Now, a new form of cyber attack has been developed, which highlights the potential future ramifications of digital assaults against the biological research sector. About 2 weeks ago or so, academics from the Ben-Gurion University of Negev described how, quote, unwitting biologists and scientists could become victims of cyber attacks designed to take biological warfare to the next level. Now, at a time where scientists worldwide are pushing ahead with the development of potential vaccines to combat the COVID-19 pandemic, Ben Gurion's team says that it's no longer the case that a threat actor needs physical access to a dangerous substance to produce or deliver it. Instead, scientists could be duped into producing toxins or synthetic viruses on behalf of the targeted cyber of those through targeted cyber attacks. Now, the research paper, which was entitled Cyber Biosecurity Remote DNA Injection Threat in Synthetic Biology, has been recently published in Nature Biotechnology, which is an academic journal. The attack documents how malware, basically an infection used to infiltrate a biologist's computer, could replace substrings in DNA sequencing, specifically weaknesses in the screening framework guidance for providers of synthetic double-stranded DNA and harmonized screening protocol version 2.0. I obviously just read that in my notes here, but what they are essentially saying is that somebody could break in to this system and basically flip the chirality of something, and instead of producing a vaccine or a cure or something that is benign, you could literally be producing something toxic. And if nobody catches that at the time of production, that one little marker has been flipped, you literally could be mass producing poison, labeling it vaccine, sending it to the world, and killing a whole bunch of people. That is biohacking. As they mentioned, they don't need physical access to poison the batch. They simply just break in, pick out the schematic or the diagram or whatever, make one little change, and boom, here we are. That is beyond terrifying. And finally, we need to talk about the European Medicines Agency, because we have this insane onslaught of attacks against COVID-19 vaccines, infrastructure, supply chain, and everything else, as I just mentioned. The European Medicines Agency, or EMA, announced that it has been targeted by a cyber attack. The EMA did not provide technical details about the attack, nor whether it will have an impact on its operations while it is evaluating and improving the COVID-19 vaccines for the European Union. Now, here was the first report I read on this, because I do my homework here, and I quote, "It is not clear just yet whether the cyber attack was successful, whether it took place, or either when it took place." Excuse me, they don't know if it was successful or when it took place. Now, the agency confirms that they have launched an investigation into this incident. Now, here's the follow-up to that, which I found absolutely interesting because, yeah, now we know. And according to Reuters, and I quote, U.S. drug maker Pfizer, obviously they're the ones that are cranking out the vaccine globally right now, and its German partner BioNTech said on Wednesday that documents related to the development of their COVID-19 vaccine has been quote-unquote unlawfully accessed in a cyber attack on Europe's medicines regulator. The EMA gets copies of essentially the map and development of a vaccine. So that is very critical information. Now the EMA, which assesses the medicines and vaccines for the EU, said that basically it had been targeted by a cyber attack. As I mentioned, it gave no other details, but Pfizer and BioNTech said they did not believe any personal data of trial participants had been compromised. And the EMA, quote, has assured us that the cyber attack will leave no impact on the timeline for its review. But this could be essentially what we're looking at here is the theft of the intellectual property that Pfizer and BioNTech have when they developed this vaccine. And so somebody else could then reproduce it. And obviously nobody's saying no to production of a vaccine, but intellectual property is intellectual property. And who knows if somebody's stealing it would actually produce it correctly, which is why Pfizer has a very rigorous, and BioNTech have very rigorous processes for the development, standardization, distribution, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That is an obvious, crazy issue. So between hacking the diagrams and turning them into poison and hitting our supply chain and stealing possible coding for vaccines, these last couple of weeks in data security and just data breaches in general has been absolutely off the rails. So as we enter into the holiday season, I have no doubt that when I see you guys on the flip side in January, we're going to have a whole laundry list, because as we ramp up, especially around Christmas, the phishing is going to absolutely explode. You think it's a Christmas card from grandma, don't click the links. You never know. So anyway, those were your breaches of the week. Were you affected? Let me know.
You're listening to Nick Espinoza here on the Deep Dive Radio Show on Huntley Community Radio, WHRULP, on 101.5 FM. And now for the Deep Dive segment, where we take a closer and deeper look at a cybersecurity, cyber warfare, or technology issue around us. And if you have any suggestions for a Deep Dive segment or something you'd like me to dive into, you can once again find me on Facebook and Twitter at Nick A. ESP. Again, that's Nick A. ESP. Or you can send an email to questions@securityfanatics.com. That's questions@securityfanatics.com. I am more than happy to take a look at it. And if it meets our standards, we are more than happy to do a deep dive on it. So let's begin.
Hey, everybody. Nick Espinoza, your chief security fanatic here. And today I have a very, very special guest with me. This is Congresswoman Robin Kelly. She is a representative of the great state of Illinois' 2nd District. I happen to be in Illinois, although not in your district. So thank you for joining me here.
And you're quite welcome.
Thank you. And we are going to be actually talking about a bill that she spearheaded, H.R. 1668, the Internet of Things, or IoT, Cybersecurity Improvement Act of 2020. Now, this was a bipartisan effort with apparently 26 co-sponsors, from what I understand. That's what I read.
I'm not quite sure the exact number, but I know that we had a good number, and it was bipartisan, so that's thrilling.
Yeah, no, that's great. That's great. And it was passed by the House, the Senate, and President Trump signed it into law. So So this is a huge win for, I think, the United States and the cybersecurity community, obviously, of which I'm part of. So Representative Kelly, can you tell us more about the bill and what this is going to do for us as Americans?
Right. The bill ensures that the government only purchases secure or securable IoT devices. You know, as COVID-19 required a shift to digital work, this is more critical now to protect U.S. systems, to protect data and national security. So that's really the gist of it.
No, and that's great. That's great. And I think that's something that the U.S. government has generally been looking at, overall. So, for example, the Department of Defense has the new cybersecurity maturity model certification that assures that supply chain that, you know, we're not sitting there allowing foreign governments to go ahead and monitor everything that we're doing. So I think that's a really good thing. And I'm really glad it passed. And I wanted
It was a long time coming.
Yeah. From what I understand, it was March of 2019 that was when it started, right?
Well, Will Hurd was the chair of the IT subcommittee, and I was the ranking Democrat. So this is when we were in the minority. And I actually brought it up to Will Hurd. Some of my staff has changed, but Matt had shepherded, Mac McMurray, my LDS, shepherded through. But I brought up to him about device vulnerabilities. This is something my staff had spoken to me about. And I think it's been like 3 years actually, or something like that, that we've been working on it. Then we had a hearing, and then Senator Warner took it up in the Senate, and his partner was Senator Gardner. That's great. We've been, you know, working on it, going back and forth, you know, listening to everybody, it seems like, you know, about the bill, and then eventually, finally, you know, everybody got together, you know, everybody agreed, bipartisan, bicameral, and voila, we had the bill.
No, that's great. And also, I think it's really good to see that we can come together, you know, both sides of the aisle and actually pass something. You know, I like to say that cybersecurity is agnostic to politics, but we're definitely not immune from it, you know, in that way. But no, but it's great. It's just really great to see. I would like to shift gears, though, to the Senate as well, because we in the cybersecurity community, I'll be honest, we've been a bit dismayed over the last couple of years that multiple election security bills have basically been put to the, have not even been put to the floor, obviously by the majority leader, McConnell, Senator Mitch McConnell. Mm-hmm. Do you think that with an incoming Biden administration in power, we're going to start these bills, we're going to start seeing these bills pass the Senate, regardless of, you know, let's say the runoffs in Georgia, whatever that makeup is?
Right. I'm sorry. I am really hoping that because of President-elect Biden's long time association and relationships with the various senators that are still there and worked with him and know, you know, what kind of person he is, that does reach across, that there will be a warming, I'll put it like that, for some of these bills, you know, cybersecurity, and I can name, you know, many others, because we sent many bipartisan bills over to the Senate that have not been handled. And I'm hoping that with a few little changes, it's a little tighter, you know, that will make a difference also. But people want us to move forward, you know, and mm-hmm. we know how important cybersecurity is, you know, national security, our elections, I mean, on and on and on.
Right. And I think we just as a nation have a lot of different issues with that. You know, I don't care if you're a CEO or grandma in Idaho or, you know, wherever you are and in between, we constantly see our data get hit, you know, whether it's the corporations that house our data or, you know, the U.S. government, whatever that is. And so, you know, and just coming through a rather contentious election, which I think we can all agree was indeed contentious, you know, it's one of those things that I think, you know, as we are resuming or trying to rebuild confidence in the electoral process, you know, that we have, you know, better cybersecurity just integrated right out of the gate. You know,
definitely. And I do think it's something that no matter, you know, what state you represent, or, you know, if you're in Congress or in the Senate, that people are, you know, they want security. You know, I do believe that, you know, most members feel like that no matter who you represent or where.
Right. Right. Well, and I think, you know, like everything, we're herd immunity for COVID. We're all in cybersecurity together, right?
That's
we're
right.
all protecting ourselves by not answering that phishing email that gets our friends on Facebook hit and all of that. And speaking of which, I think one of the things that the United States tends to be lacking is something that the European Union, the EU, put together and ratified in 2018, and that is their General Data Protection Regulations, or GDPR, that allows EU citizens the right to be forgotten, the right to handle their data, whether they're on Facebook or another platform. And I think that you know, if the United States had a GDPR here, whatever we wanted to call it, that seems like it would be in line with the Constitution's right to privacy. Mm-hmm. And so as a representative of in Congress, what do you think about the U.S. passing a GDPR? Do we have a chance? We've seen this in California with the CCPA, and New York has their shield. Here in Illinois, as you know, we have the biometric, you know, regulations. But overall, as a national standard, do you think we have a shot at passing a GDPR?
You know, it's so hard to say, but I would say I think we have a better shot now maybe than we did a year ago or 2 years ago. And I think it would be important to hear from, you know, California, Illinois, New York, people that have put, or states that have put some things in place and have hearings about it. I'm no longer, you know, well, there's no more IT subcommittee. It's all under Rep Conley. It was merged together with his committee. But I think those are proved to be interesting hearings to get feedback.
What do you think would stop a GDPR from coming into play? I mean, if we have bipartisan support to protect IoT security for the U.S. government, mm-hmm. and we've got the DoD ensuring their supply chain is no longer going to be stolen by state-sponsored attackers, what do you think it would take for the government, the federal government, to spin that up for the citizens?
You know, some of my colleagues, they believe in, you know, small government, stay out of our way, and also they believe in more state rights. So, you know, I don't know if they would feel like each state needs to do something, which, you know, we've found with different pieces of legislation and different issues, that doesn't make sense, you know, to have 50 different, you know, systems, that one system would be easier. But really, I don't know. Like I said, I don't know if it would be a state right thing. My colleagues talk about that often, but it's hard to say.
It is.
This last 4 years has me, you know, sometimes I don't know what people are going to think or why they're going to do what they do.
Yes. The last million years in the last 4 years, I think, is the consensus for quite a bit. I mean, the way I think we look at it here, just in the American cybersecurity community, is that it dovetails with the constitutional right to privacy. And so as our privacy moves online, or, you know, as we start, I don't know, colonizing the moon, wherever it is, our privacy goes with us, whether we're in cyberspace or physical space. And by virtue of that, I'd actually like to jump gears again and talk about some recent news that we heard. My colleague Chris Krebs, who ran the CISA, which is obviously the cybersecurity wing of the Department of Homeland Security, was recently fired by President Trump after he disputed the president's claims. And Chris Krebs said this was the most secure election from a cybersecurity standpoint in the history of the United States. Now, by virtue of that, there have been some public calls that we've seen in the media to basically have his position, or his former position, I should say, or a very similar position, essentially be appointed and confirmed by Congress, so that a president could not unilaterally dismiss who is ostensibly the head of cybersecurity for the entire U.S. government. And I'm very curious to know what your thoughts are on that entire situation, and if a position like that is actually tenable, you know, to be passed or ratified.
Well, first of all, it's absolutely ridiculous that he got fired. And you would think that someone in charge — I've never been the president, but I've been the chief of staff and in charge of things. And like right now, I want my staff to feel like they can tell me the truth, whether it's something I really want to hear or not. But if it's the truth, then it's going to help me do my job better, or just to be more aware of what's needed. I would want to hear that. And the thing is, because it's been President Trump, I think we need to look at a lot of different things. But do we change everything because of him? I'm hoping, and not trying to be disrespectful, that he was more of an anomaly, you know, because there are a lot of things we thought were safe and secure that now it doesn't, you know, we have to look back and question, you know. But I wouldn't be opposed to it being an appointment. But before we jump to doing that, we need to come to the table, talk about it, talk about the pros and cons. Because unfortunately, even though we get along better than people think, but also things have been so politicized, you know, I feel like it really started going the wrong way under President Obama. And it's just gone, you know, from there, the way that I saw that he was treated, you know. So I wouldn't mind the conversation around it, but I just want to make sure we're not, because of what has happened, we're not jumping to change everything. But and I would like his opinion too, what he thinks about it.
Yeah, and I think that's a really good position to take. You know, I've written multiple articles for Forbes or Smirkanish of CNN. I write for both, and we seem to have this bifurcation going on. You know, not just on the political divide of right versus left, but even on social media platforms. And how do you, as a nation, come together? I mean, it's just very heartwarming to me to see that. I think something that is beyond important to the security of this country had overwhelming bipartisan support. I don't know what the complete vote total was of all 435 members, but I have to imagine there were very few people that probably opposed what I think is a very
obvious. It was not opposed at all.
Yeah, so that's amazing. Right? We don't hear about those things.
I know.
Yeah. Yeah. I think more people need to understand that it's not just pointing fingers and all of that. But yeah, go ahead, please.
No, I was going to say the truth of the matter is when we did have the IT subcommittee, Will Hurd and Mark Meadows, Jerry Conley and myself, we worked together a lot on different, and they were the, as I always say, they drugged me along. You know, I was the average Jane or Joe on the street, and I learned so much from them, and especially from Will Hurd. I mean, being ex-CIA, he was really in, you know, to all of this. And so I learned a lot, and then I taught them a lot because, you know, as you said, the nerd to English, you know, kind of thing, right, and what the average person thinks about or would want to know. So I feel like we really, I call us the Fantastic Four. We work together a lot, you know, around these issues and trying to modernize, you know, government and just different things like that.
And so Representative Kelly, thank you very much. And if people want to learn more about you or follow you or anything else, are there any places or Twitter or anything you'd like to plug?
RobinKelly.gov. They can go on and, you know, and of course, and just Google me, Congresswoman Robin Kelly, and all sorts of stuff pops up.
Fair enough. All good, I hope. All good.
Oh, yeah. And at Robin Kelly, yeah.
Great. Well, Representative Kelly, thank you so much for your time. It is greatly appreciated.
And thank you so much for tuning in this week. It was another fun show, and I think we covered a lot of really good stuff, and I hope you guys enjoyed it as much as I did. It was a really good time, and I hope you keep tuning in. Thank you very much for listening to the Deep Dive Radio Show here with Nick Espinoza, and if you have any comments, suggestions, questions, absolutely anything, once again, you can find me on Facebook and Twitter at Nick AESP. Again, that's Nick AESP, and you can always send an email to questions@securityfanatics.com. Don't be shy. I love the feedback. We've been having a great time with the show, and as always, stay safe and stay online, everyone. Thanks for listening.